Andy Warhol was definitely an experimenter and an innovator, and he was definitely ahead of his time in a lot of ways. He, you know, obviously, not only with his being in touch with the media of his times and connecting with that, interfacing with it, but as far as, well, like, for example, like using abstraction in unique and different ways. Like, you're being inspired by Jackson Pollock to do the oxidation pieces, like in like 1977-78. I don't know if you saw those up on the fifth floor or not. Did you?
I definitely went up there.
Okay.
And I think I've seen them before. Those are more part of the permanent exhibit.
They are,
right?
Part of the permanent collection. Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah. On that too, with media, I think about how, and I don't know how far we want to get into like Andy as an artist, but like the structure of his career, I think, is fascinating. Most artists at that time as well, where they start out in this commercial aspect, and then that leads to the development of their career.
Right.
As their own artistic expression, where they've then built up at least a reputation or connections or whatever.
And Andy certainly got his start in terms of in the professional art world. Yes, he definitely got his start as a commercial artist in New York during the 1950s, after he left Pittsburgh in 49, after he graduated college. CMU, by the way, he went to college here. Mm-hmm. Wasn't called CMU then. It was called Carnegie Tech.
Yeah.
But he got his degree in, I guess, what the modern equivalent would be graphic design nowadays. That's what you would call it, basically. But yeah, after he moved to New York, and, you know, he, of course, got started in the realm of working as a commercial artist, doing contracts, you know, like with Bonwit Teller and I. Miller Shoes and so forth. But he was always a personal and fine artist. You know, even in his youth, you know, he flexed his creative edge and, you know, tried to, you know, figure out, like, you know, what sort of fine art he was going to do, experimented with a lot of different things. Even through the 50s, when he was working as a commercial artist, he did do a lot of personal work. The thing was that it wasn't until he got into the realm of pop art in the 60s that was when his career as a personal and fine artist began to take off publicly. In the 50s, although, you know, he had a good reputation in New York as a commercial artist, people didn't take him seriously as a personal or fine artist at that time. You know, they considered his work to be too progressive, avant-garde, homoerotic in certain cases, you know, and so... So your gallery owners, like back then, you generally did not want to have his stuff featured, especially being this was the 1950s, even in a place like New York, which was a little more on the progressive side of things. Still, it was America of the 1950s. And so it wasn't until he got into his work as a pop artist in the 60s. And a lot of that came from being driven from his work as a commercial artist. You know, he looked at what was going on, like, you know, because being a commercial artist, you know, he had his finger on the pulse of American consumerism, and, you know, and so he thought, well, you know, how can I transfer my success as a commercial artist to being taken seriously as a personal and fine artist? Well, what are people looking at in the media? What are people buying? You know, what are the common everyday type of mundane things that people interact with, which can appeal to the eye and become not only, you know, have an aesthetic quality, but can also be used to make art and get it out there and to make money with it. So these were the things going on with him in the early 60s, and that's when he started to turn to the world of pop art. First by hand, doing pop art by hand, and then adopting the screen printing process, which of course allowed him to produce tons of pop art in mass quantities, with multiple series and stuff over the years. And that is, of course, what most people know him as a screen print artist. Yeah.
And I think of, too, like, when I think of Andy Warhol, I think of, like, one-man show. But I rarely, I know. So can you speak about that? Like, I'm especially interested in, did he have an agent? Who were his collaborators? Who put him, did he put himself on the map? Who put him on the map? You know, so, or is it this gradual commercial, you know?
Yeah, so during the 50s, of course, Andy had developed a lot of contacts and networks as a commercial artist. That began to expand, of course, as he began to be a prolific and well-known pop artist. You know, his creation of the Factory in New York, like in 1964, you know, that began, the Factory.
Yeah.
The Factory, also known as his Silver Factory, that was a, it was a studio.
Okay.
It was a place where he and others did art. Did screen printing, made films, but not only was it that, but it also became sort of a social hub. And it became a place in New York where people could go to hang out, to party, to network, to make connections with other people. And it was especially valuable at a time when members of the LGBTQ community you know, didn't have a lot of safe places to go to. That became one of those safe places. And it became a place where a lot of people who maybe would not have normally had opportunities to get into art, to get into media, to get into show, to do all of these sort of things, the Factory gave them an opportunity for that. And it attracted crowds across a whole spectrum of people. You know, members of the Rolling Stones went there to party. You know, the Velvet Underground, Nico. But a lot of the people who worked with Andy and who kind of became part of his circle, you know, were part of that Factory scene. Like Gerard Malanga was his studio assistant for many years. You know, people like Jane Holzer, you know, like Edie Sedgwick. You know, gosh, there are like lots of names. Many of the people who appeared in films. Some of them who even went on to get into mainstream film afterwards, people like Holly Woodlawn or Joe D'Alessandro and Ultraviolet. You know, so these were all people, you know, who were kind of part of that scene. But yes, you know, Andy was not a one-man show by any means. Yeah, he had studio assistants. He had helpers like those oxidized pieces up on Five. You know, well, he didn't do all of that peeing on the canvas by himself. You know, I mean, you know, he had people who, like, who came in who were there at the Factory, you know. Well, like, here's an idea. We're going to put this in, like, you know, copper-painted, you know, canvas, and we're going to try some oxidation here. All right. Go ahead and pee on it. It's like, you know,
open,
I mean.
Open door, bathroom, whatever you want to
Right,
say, yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
And as the years went on and as his circle expanded and as he not only gained national fame but international fame, those networks continued to develop. Like, for example, on the second floor on our unseen exhibit, we have a section called the Art World, which are portraits of people who were part of that circle, who Andy interacted with and knew, not necessarily art, although some of them were artists, but a lot of them were just like people who were like art connoisseurs, collectors, people who were kind of involved in that scene. You know, and so when you go up there, you know, you'll see like people, like pictures, portraits of like Berkeley Reinhold and Michael Chow, you know, so, you know.
He's by no means a one-man show.
Oh,
yeah,
no,
yeah,
no,
yeah,
not at all, not at all. And so, like, for a lot of his work, his assistants and helpers there in the Factory would do like a lot of the screen prints and such. Absolutely,
I think,
yeah.
I've never heard of the Factory. That's a new fact I've learned about Andy just in this conversation. I think it's really interesting that he chose to call it a factory to like play into that commercialism.
His commercial background,
yeah.
Right? Absolutely, yeah. No, I think that was a very well chosen word because it not only was it a place, you know, to hang out and party and have fun, but it was also an actual working studio. And the Factory went through a few different addresses over the years. It didn't stay in the same place. I think maybe over the course of his career, like when he opened it up, like I think like in early '64, I think is when he first opened up. like for like the next like 20 years, it would go through like a few different places there, but all like in Manhattan, all kind of in the general same area. But,
yeah. How much, just to kind of try to tie in his Pittsburgh background mm-hmm. with that aspect as well, with Pittsburgh being known for industrialism mm-hmm. and maybe a degree of commercialism, probably more so in New York. Do you think that, or what's your perception of the Pittsburgh influence in that factory space?
Well, there's definitely a strong influence. You know, Andy Warhol was, you know, the son of Eastern European immigrants, and you know, he learned a, you know, solid blue collar work ethic, you know, from his youth, and that was definitely ingrained in him, and he was always, I mean, through that was life, you know, even, you know, up until his death, even during his like periods of illness, whatever, he was still always working, he was always creating, he was always promoting, always innovating. I mean, it was a constant thing for him, and it's kind of ironic in the sense that even though, you know, Warhol came from blue collar roots, you know, that, you know, Steel City background and such, when he left Pittsburgh in 49 to, you know, after he graduated college and went to New York, he did not come back to Pittsburgh very much at all. There was kind of a distance that he sort of put between himself and Pittsburgh. You know, I don't think he wanted to be identified, you know, with Pittsburgh necessarily. He wanted the New York scene. That was what he wanted to be identified with. And but you can take the boy out of Pittsburgh, but you can't really fully take the Pittsburgh out of the boy. And those,
I think that'll be the title of the article.
Those awesome. Well, you can use it and you can quote me on it.
That's awesome. I totally will.
Yeah. And that upbringing and those roots, I think, stayed with him. And even though he did make an effort to kind of distance himself from his Pittsburgh upbringing in many ways, in some ways he could never really escape it. For example, his mother, Julia, lived with him in New York for nearly 20 years. When, let's see, her husband, Andy's father, died when Andy was like around 13 or 14. And then when her two older sons, Paul and John, when they were Andy's older brothers, when they were already like grown and married, had kids and everything, she left Pittsburgh and moved in with Andy, lived with him there for like, from like 1952, I think, is when she moved, to a year before she died. She died in 1972. Same year that I was born. That gives you just a sense how
sure.
how ancient I am. No. And
more like lost one, gained another, you know.
And but a year before she died, she moved back to Pittsburgh. But for a period of 19 years, yeah, she lived with Andy there in New York. And so yeah, it's like he couldn't, he never really escaped. I mean, his upbringing and his
roots. It followed him,
absolutely, yeah. And you know, he maintained connections with his family. In fact, Donald Warhola, I don't know if you know Donald, okay. He works with us here. He's on the board of the Warhol Foundation. Okay. He spends time here at the museum. He would have been a fascinating person to interview. He's Andy's nephew.
Okay.
The youngest son of John Warhola, who was Andy's brother, that was the second son. Okay. John was the Paul was the oldest. John was the second son, and then Andy. Right. So Donald was John's youngest kid. He's Andy's nephew, and you know, he tells stories about like during the 80s, like after Donald was in college, he went to New York, actually spent some time working with his uncle and such, you know, so
at the factory,
yeah. So it's like they're absolutely, it's like he still maintained connections with his family.
Sure,
yeah,
definitely. Sure. Yeah. I think that's just a life thing, right?
Sure,
like you can move away from home, but like the connections are still there for sure. I want to shift a little bit into less about the artist mm-hmm. and more about the art.
Okay.
So I think if I'm remembering the Unseen exhibit correctly, there's even portions of that that focus on his use of color. There was mm-hmm. a component of that. Can you
abstract
speak on
color,
that
sure.
yeah, aspect of Andy?
So it's interesting that Andy went through a lot of phases, a lot of different styles and experimentation through his career. When you look at a lot of his earlier work, like in the 50s, like with the blotted line technique, there is a sense of realism, but a sort of, I don't know how to describe it exactly. It's a little bit of sort of a, progressive avant-garde kind of a realism that he embraces with a lot of his early work. As he got further along in his career, of course, he spent a lot of time in the 60s doing film, screen prints of actors and celebrities and such. But as he got into his commissioned portraits era in the 70s, where he began to do portraits on commission from people, he moved into a period of abstract work. Well, a lot of this was inspired by Jackson Pollock and such. The oxidation pieces were kind of a part of that movement. And so what you will see in a lot of his work, and the second floor definitely has a lot of examples of this, is his experimenting with color to try to find, his style of abstract work. And a lot of what you'll notice with Andy's abstraction is that a lot of times it will be coupled with very realistic pieces. Like, for example, he might do something that looks very colorful and abstract, but then he'll include some symbolic image on top of that, like a screen print or something, or something that seems offset and not, this doesn't look very abstract. It looks very realistic, but it's amidst this abstraction. And that was very Warhol-ish, blending and experimenting with things. Even when he was a commercial artist, part of what got him his success as a commercial artist was that his style of commercial art was so different from what other people were doing. I mean, most industrial artwork at that time was very Norman Rockwell-ish. That was kind of the norm. That was the standard, that people in post-World War II conservative America were using for commercial professional art. Well, Andy was not Norman Rockwell-ish. His style of realistic expression was quite different. And I think that carries over into his abstract era and experiment with colors, trying to find those kind of blends.
Rockwell was in New York. That's where he was based.
Rockwell was also, but he was
quite, he was in New York City, though, wasn't he?
I believe, if I'm not mistaken, I think so.
I'm only saying that because I went to the Rockwell Museum.
Are you talking about Rockefeller or Rockwell?
I'm talking about Rockwell. Okay. Yeah.
Pretty sure it was. I'm not mistaken.
So they would have been contemporaries, or Rockwell would have been a little
Rockwell
bit before.
Was a generation
was a
before.
Bit before.
Yeah, he okay. was. Rockwell started his works in the 1920s and such, and Warhol was born in 28.
Okay.
So yeah, he was a generation before. But it's interesting, Rockwell died he died only maybe about a decade before Andy did.
Yeah,
trying
to think of
New York City based.
New York City based. Okay.
Yeah. That's what I thought.
I think I'm kind of going back to Andy the person, but just the influences that he saw at Carnegie Technology, would he have studied Rockwell? Would he have what was that?
Yes, there probably would have been some Rockwell-ish influence. So, Andy, of course, did his schooling, here in Pittsburgh at CMU. This would have been in the late 1940s. I know that Marcel Duchamp, the French artist, was an inspiration on some of his pop art work. In terms of when he was in school, he would have studied artists who were late 19th century or early 20th century. I was absolutely right.
And I'm thinking too, Rothko would have been after Andy, right?
Who?
Rothko. Norman, am I saying Mark Rothko?
Oh, yes. Yes. Yes.
So trying to think of his use of color and wondering, like, and that's a degree of abstraction as well, if there was any influence possibly from Andy's work into Rothko's.
That's a good question. That's a good question. I know that in terms of time frame, I think they were like around the same time.
And the question here is that I'm like trying to get is of like Rothko uses color, show like assigns meaning to so much color, right? And I'm wondering like how much meaning Andy assigned color. Like I'm thinking of those portraits that we know so well where there's like the dark black, but there's a certain color. And I know he's done others in various colors. Like, did he know Marilyn this color? You know what I mean? Like what?
Yeah, that's a really good question. I was just looking at the dates of Rothko's birth and death because I wasn't sure exactly like what his exact time frame was. Yeah, no, he was born about 25 years before Andy, and he died in 1970. So I mean, they would have been contemporaries in terms of doing some of the work. There was probably influence back and forth. In terms of, well, like for example, if we're talking about like use of color, like with screen prints. I know that like in the case of Marilyn, for example, he did multiple series, okay? And a lot of what Andy, I think, was trying to accomplish with his different series, particularly of like his like pop portraits, like celebrities, was exploring like through color, like different moods and aspects of a celebrity. The one that we have upstairs in Maryland, that's a 1967 series. Well, of course, the prominent feature of that, of course, is the big hot pink, you know, lips and the earrings and such. Okay. Well, timing is kind of interesting in that, you know, he did that about 5 years after Marilyn died and after he did his first Marilyn series. Well, he did that again in 1967. Well, what was going on in 1967? Well, Summer of Love, Monterey Pop Festival, hippie movement, Haight-Ashbury, you know. And I'm thinking, well, maybe, but there's also, there's some darker backgrounds in that piece as well, but there's that hot pink. Was he perhaps kind of going with like the contrast of like the flower power movement of the Summer of Love versus also all the other stuff that was going on in around that time too? Is what else was happening? You know, America was embroiled, you know, in the Vietnam War, the Civil Rights Movement, such, of course. You know, there was a lot of light and dark going on in America. You see a lot of that contrast with many of his pieces. His choices of celebrities I find fascinating because like for example Natalie Wood. So we have that set of prints of Natalie Wood up there on the 6-4. Well, if you look at it, there's a lot of very clear pictures, a lot of very clear images, but then there's a lot of very dark, muddy crossover, right? Well, Natalie had been a child star right around the time that he did that particular series. She had just gotten kind of reached the height of her fame. Playing the role of Maria in West Side Story from 1961. But right around that same time, she was also going through a very messy divorce with her husband, Robert Wagner. The first time that she went through, the first time she was married to Robert Wagner. Then, of course, there's a second time and the boat and all of that, yes. But
I actually don't know it, but
okay. Yeah, well, fascinating. If you do a little research on Natalie Wood's life, you'll see some interesting things.
Yeah. Her co-star learned just recently passed away. Not Maria. It would have been her. Or was it Maria? The actress that played Maria. I forget. Someone from West Side Story, the original one, just recently passed away. Tangent, looping back.
Rita Moreno?
Maybe, yes.
Did she die?
I think. Maybe. That
she was like in her 90s. She was she was like one of the did she seriously die?
I think so.
Oh my that's God. Ringing a bell. I did not know that.
Like okay,
hold on. Hold on. I have
you're
to
like,
check
this
now.
This is groundbreaking.
I got to check now.
Yeah.
Oh my God, I love Rita Moreno. Oh my God. I remember her when she was on the original Electric Company back in the 70s when I was a kid and watched that.
Oh my gosh.
Hold on. Rita Moreno.
Is it?
She's still
she's
alive.
Not. Okay. Never
I was going to say,
good.
Oh my
okay,
God, if
good.
She died,
sorry
I'd be like,
the big
no.
Sorry for the big scare.
Okay, all right.
But someone in the cast recently did. Tangent, back
but,
to
yeah,
Evie.
That's fine. but dealing with that, you know, the work, that contrast, right? The whole idea about, you know, the light, the dark, the fame of Hollywood, the glamour, the spotlight versus, like, the hardship, deaths, suicides, drugs, marriage, divorce, et cetera, right? You know, and so you can see a lot of that in his pop portraits. With Marilyn, it's kind of interesting. You know, his use of color with the screen print process over the years in different series explored a lot of those themes, like the moods of Marilyn. You know, he did like a Blue Marilyn series. He did a Reversal series back in the late 70s, which was kind of like silhouette-y, sort of dark in some way. You know, the one, of course, that we have up there from 1967, these original Marilyn diptych from 1962. All of these different Marilyn series, you know, they captured different, I guess, you know, aspects of the actress. And, of course, Marilyn Monroe is a very complex person. And through color, the artist, like Manny, is able to explore those different shades of Marilyn. And he did that with a lot of these different celebrities and pop portraits and using, and of course, the power of the screen print process, being able to take a source image, but then use the screen print over that to be able to do things with color that creates a unique piece of art, even though it's based on the same source image.
Just because you mentioned it, I will likely want to address the silk screening process a little brief. You don't have to go into all the details, but a brief overview of that process.
Absolutely, yeah. So, of course, it's called silk screening because a long time ago, and the process had been around like since the Middle Ages. It was in China way, hundreds of years ago. Back a long time ago, they actually used to use real silk screens. Now, they haven't used real silk in a long time. They use, like, a synthetic mesh now. But the idea of the screen print is, like, taking a source image, like a positive image on an acetate, like what Andy is holding up right there in that picture, Marilyn, okay? That's, like, a positive image, right? An acetate, right? Well, if you place that onto a screen that's been, like, mounted and framed, right? And then if you coat the screen with emulsion, which is a light-sensitive material, and then if you expose the emulsion-coated screen with an image on it to strong light, because emulsion's light-sensitive, what's going to happen is that it's going to harden, but it's only going to harden in the areas where the light can get to it. The light can't get to it in the areas where the image is because that's darkened. So, when you pull it out after it's done, what you'll have is most of the screen in the areas where you want blocked, that's going to be hardened. But the areas then where the image was, well, the emulsion's still going to be gooey. It didn't harden because the light couldn't get to it. You can wash it away. And then you have now a screen with the only places where things can get through the screen is in the areas where the image was. Everything else is going to be blocked because of the hardened emulsion. Then, all you do is, you know, you take that screen with the image now. They call it burned on it. It's not a really accurate term, but that's what they call it. You take that image, you know, that screen with the image burned on it, apply it to a canvas, and then when you put the ink on it, and then squeegee the ink right across it, only places the ink's going to get through is where the image is. Take off the screen, and there's your image. We actually have a video sample of it up on the sixth floor showing Andy and Gerard Malanga doing a screen print of a Marlon Brando image.
And it plays
It's on a loop. Yep, it's on a loop.
I feel like we've touched really well on Andy the artist, the art that the artist produced, a little bit about his life. Next and probably final aspect of it all is the legacy. And so you mentioned at the top, we're close to, did you say 37 years since his death? 34?
It'll be 37 years this coming February 22nd since he died.
Okay. And getting to that bit about, you know, Andy primarily had his career in New York City, and yet the Warhol Museum, named after him, is in Pittsburgh.
Sure.
So speaking about, just that the legacy, the importance of the Warhol's presence in Pittsburgh, and wondering if you could even tie in that to a conversation with the other art museums in the area.
Well, when Andy Warhol died in 87, he died of complications of gallbladder surgery. He was only 58 and a half, only a little older than I am. A lot of people, there's some questions that I get. A lot of people ask me questions about, you know, because they, once they find out that Andy was an openly gay man, and the fact that he died in 87, a lot of people assume that he died of AIDS. Not true. Andy was never HIV positive. He died of complications of gallbladder surgery. But when he died, the Andy Warhol Foundation was established. Okay, the idea being to, you know, categorize his work, to document it, to preserve it, archive it and such. And also to be able to make sure that there was a legacy of Andy's life and work to continue. The foundation partnered with the Carnegie Museums of Pittsburgh to create the Andy Warhol Museum. Pittsburgh was chosen, of course, because this is where Andy was originally from. And this is it's the youngest of the museums. All three of our other museums are older, and they have been here longer. So it was a really good partnership as far as, you know, this was a group that already had museums here in Pittsburgh, and the foundation, of course, given the fact that Andy was from Pittsburgh and a famous artist, we're about to celebrate our 30th anniversary here. The museum opened in 94, and it has been a point of cultural and artistic interest and attraction for all of those years, especially in a time back in 94 when Pittsburgh was struggling to, I'm assuming you've been here in Pittsburgh for a long time. Okay.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Okay.
Just grew up just outside of
Sydney. Okay, all right. Well, you might, I didn't. This is not my hometown, but I know enough about Pittsburgh's history to know that, you know, there came a point after its industrial era that Pittsburgh was struggling to keep afloat and to try to find ways to keep the city going. Once, you know, the whole industrial aspect of the city died and such. But there's been a lot of efforts, of course, in recent years to build up Pittsburgh, you know, in terms of being a progressive and 21st century city. And bringing in arts and culture and stuff has been a major part of that. The whole cultural district downtown, the Carnegie Museums, all of this, you know, the Heinz, everything that they've tried to, you know, help to, you know, bring, you know, a renewed sense of life to Pittsburgh, which has been very successfully done. So the Warhol Museum was coming into a time when that was starting to happen, and so there was opportunity. This building, actually, this is the old Frick Lindsay building. This was built in 1911. This was an industrial warehouse for many years during Pittsburgh's steel era. Back in the 70s and 80s, it was a music store. And then it was empty for a period of time, and that, of course, is when the foundation and the Carnegie came together, got this building, and then refit it to be the... But it's interesting. if you walk through this museum and look at its structure, you'll see that the warehouse kind of aesthetics are still in play. And I like that because it's kind of it's an homage to Pittsburgh's industrial heritage, but it's also an homage to Andy's factory and being a commercial artist and having that commercial side to him. And I like it that the museum has kept that sort of industrial looking structure.
That's like the heart of it all. And I think that's what this will be my last question, I think, with that idea of factory, which again, like, new to me, but I love it so much because it does speak so much about how Andy carried Pittsburgh with him in the way that he created art. And so the question I think here is, how is the Warhol, and I think you already touched up on it in terms of how the building came to be, but for the artists themselves, how are they, and how is the Warhol Museum today inviting artists in to create it like it is a factory, or creating more space for art to happen? Because I'm thinking of this in terms of, had Pittsburgh had that kind of structure back in Andy's day, would he have had to go to New York?
You know, and that's a great question. Back when he graduated college in 49, you know, Pittsburgh was still very much an industrial city. It didn't have the same kind of cultural and artistic aspects that it has today. Back then, you know, a Pittsburgh boy wanting to be an artist, you know, you'd want to go to a place where art was thriving. Of course, at that point, New York City was like the big place. There are some other reasons, I think, too. Being a young gay man, I think staying in Pittsburgh would have been extremely difficult for him at that time. Nowadays, it's quite different, but back then, New York would have seemed the most attractive option. In terms of going for, and I think I'm glad you asked about as far as the continuing legacy in terms of like artists and education, because that's what I do. I'm an arts educator. And so the museum, part of our mission, is very much dedicated to the idea of promoting art here in Pittsburgh. We partner. In fact, the Warhol Museum is the centerpiece of the Pop District, which for the last couple years has been trying to sort of create an artistic cultural center point here on the North Shore, to invite local artists to participate, like that mural right across the street there. You'll see some of the other, you know, works around here that other artists have like helped to do, like the Warhol Academy, youth programs, being very much in tune with the LGBTQ community here. Of course, that's part of Andy's legacy also, and wanting to provide opportunities for inclusion and such. And giving other artists opportunity, for example, our upcoming exhibit, when Unseen closes, which will be in just a few days, March 4th is our last day of the Unseen. March 4th, it's just a few days away, I know, it's not far. We'll have about a 10-week transition period for installation, and then in late May, we're going to be opening up an exhibit on Kaws, K-A-W-S, who is an art, I don't know if you're familiar with who Kaws is. That's not his original name. Kaws, K-A-W-S, that is his, like...
Current artist.
He's actually younger than I am.
Okay.
So he is a New York, Jersey-based artist who has, for like the last 30 years or so, been doing a lot of work. You might be, if you go online and research his work, you'll be able to see his stuff. Companion is one of his well-known pieces. A lot of his stuff takes like images from like pop art or like characters from the media and creating like very kind of interesting like balloon styled heads and stuff. You might be familiar with his work. If you see some of his stuff, you might recognize.
Yeah.
But anyway, so Andy Warhol, of course, was one of his inspirations, and so we're bringing a cause exhibit here in late May that's going to be with us through the summer and in the fall, so things like that. Paula Peavy, we did an exhibit of Paula Peavy's work back in 2022.
Is that also like a
That's also a current artist. So like we'll do, like for example, like sound series, like local talent, performers, musicians. We operate a sound series where we'll get people to be able to come in and do performances. I don't know if you've ever been to any of our concerts here.
I don't. It's always on my to-do list. Yeah. And then I think you also do the Art in the Alley or something like that.
Yes.
Might be mm-hmm. a portion of that.
The Silver Alley. We have events during the months when we can have outside events, right? Yeah. We'll do things there. We do programs like the Youth Arts Council. We operate the Factory downstairs, which is an actual hands-on studio that people can participate. We do outreach programs to schools, to shelters, to organizations, libraries. We have opportunities for like schools and other organizations to come in and do workshops here on site. We operate the Print Lounge, which is again part of the Pop District. It's across the street. It's a kind of a larger sort of a working space to be able to do projects. And you may have heard this in the news. We now are going to be opening up a new space, a catty corner from us, where that parking lot is.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So that's kind of a new thing.
A new building? Or
an actual building. That's going to be, that parking lot is going to be torn down and converted. They're actually going to be building a structure there, which is going to be part of the Warhol Museum and Pop District space to be able to be a venue space. So, of course, we're kind of limited here, and people love to use the Warhol for all sorts of venues and events and special things like that. Well, with the new facility over there, which will also have like offices and such, but mainly it's going to be devoted to like a special event venue space. Like his factory, where we can hold all sorts of like functions, concerts, all sorts of things that people can use that for to help to attract awareness of what's going on here.
Yeah. Yeah. I love the idea of, because I feel like so many concerts take place in like sports arenas or something like that. Come on, that's great.
Yeah, we're gonna have it. We're gonna have an actual yeah. entertainment space.
That'll be
there.
Really
yeah.
cool. Yeah. That'll be really really cool.
And that's gonna be. They're going to probably start building that in the coming months. And
okay.
so, yeah.
Okay. It's so good yeah. to hear that, you know, his legacy is continuing,
Absolutely.
That his life's work is continuing. I'm so caught up on that factory bit. I feel like someone told him, like, you're not going to make it as an artist. You're going to end up in a factory. Or, like, that was
yeah.
what he was told he should become.
Sure.
And he's like, well, sure. Joke's on you. I'm still going to be an artist.
Yeah. I'll end up in a factory. I'm just going to end up in my factory. So
exactly.
It's like,
it speaks so much to his creativity and his, you know, willingness to disturb the status quo in a really groundbreaking way.